So, greetings, friends. Today's Dhamma talk is on the Sambodhi Sutta, the Sutta on the Wings to Self-Awakening. And in this sutta, the Buddha stresses the importance of having, in the translated words, admirable friends in the Dhamma to help support our practice and to remain focused and not get distracted by other practices. And so it was common, obviously, during the Buddha's time, as well as today, where our associations can either be a support to our Dhamma practice or can actually keep us distracted from remaining focused on the Buddha's simple Dhamma. So I'll read the article. It's on the website too. In the Sambodhi Sutta, the Wings of Self-Awakening, the Buddha teaches the importance of admirable friends and supporting the process of self-awakening. And even that phrase, self-awakening, is so important. The Buddha consistently impressed that it was through our own efforts that we will awaken, just as he awakened through his own efforts. In other words, awakening, as far as the Buddha's teachings are concerned, and probably I think a better word is gaining full human maturity, is developed through our own efforts. It's not something that's bestowed on us by an outside agency or a higher being or the Buddha himself. It really has nothing to do with doing a string of good acts, which will eventually result in gaining some type of Buddhist heaven. Or simply engaging in a matter or a list of endless rituals that are only just another distraction from developing the Buddha's path. The Buddha taught a simple and direct path for recognizing our own contributions to distraction, confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, and a way to directly abandon those, again, through our own effort. So the Buddha was at Anathapindika's monastery at Jeta's Grove. He asked those gathered, "Friends, if those of other sects would ask you, what are the prerequisites for developing the wings of self-awakening, how would you respond?" The monks and nuns asked the Buddha for his response, as if hearing the Buddha's words, excuse me, they would remember it clearly. The Buddha then said, "Listen closely then. The prerequisites for developing the wings to self-awakening are here for you," meaning that they're available to everyone through his Dhamma. Another important point: there's nothing exclusive about the Buddha's teachings. He's talking to people that are used to a Brahmin system and a caste system, where you had to be even in a certain caste level to even hear so-called spiritual teachings, much less have the opportunity to awaken. And the Buddha said that's all nonsense, that every human being has within them the capabilities and the potential for awakening. The only requirement is that you follow the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha continues. The first factor, the first prerequisite, is having admirable friends and companions. So, of course, the Buddha is not talking that we should only associate with people that are well-focused in the Dhamma, but the important point is that as far as our Dhamma practice is concerned, that we associate with people that are well-focused in that Dhamma, or they're only going to lead to more confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. Then he says, remaining virtuous and restrained and understanding the danger of even the slightest fault. This is something that the Buddha talks about so consistently for the 45 years of his teaching career. It's not that we should be so overly analytical and hyper vigilant about every single thought, word, and deed, but we should be vigilant about that. Even the slightest fault is going to prove to be it's going to prove to lead to more confusion, more deluded thinking, and more suffering. So even taking license with the Dhamma, and we might have some in the context of this teaching. Even though we may have friends that are well-intentioned, even the slightest fault, meaning being influenced by that, can have devastating results. So it is up to us to develop an understanding of what this means to have admirable friends, and also using the framework of the Eightfold Path to keep a well-focused Dhamma practice. And there's also another inference here, that if we are practicing the Buddhist teachings, we have to recognize our own influence that we have on others. And if we're going to be a Dhamma practitioner, it's important that we understand what that means, and that there's a responsibility that it carries by being well-focused and maintaining that. The Buddha continues, hearing easily sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. Of course, that means to be a part of a well-focused Sangha, and to be aware of what the pitfalls of being in, I've been using this word, this phrase a lot lately, a kind of one-size-fits-all Dhamma that incorporates every possible Buddhist teaching. But most of those aren't what the Buddha actually taught. It's only a distraction. The Buddha continues, hearing talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet non-entanglement, hearing talks on persistence and virtue and concentration and discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. Again, the importance of a well-focused Sangha. Remaining persistent for abandoning unskillful mental qualities and for developing skillful mental qualities. Resolute in right effort, that sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. Furthermore, for one developing the wings to self-awakening, they would maintain discernment and understanding of the of impermanence and the cessation of stress, meaning developing the Eightfold Path. Again, the Buddha is just reinforcing the importance of maintaining focus within the framework of the path that he developed, the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, when one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will be virtuous and restrained, seeing danger and even the slightest faults. Again, the Buddha is putting that emphasis on remaining well-focused on the Dhamma, not getting caught up in distractions of other practices, even practices that may have that label of Buddhism. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected they will hear sober talks and talks conducive to gaining understanding. Again, he's emphasizing that point. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected they will maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. Again, reinforcing the focus is ultimately on maintaining an understanding of the three marks of existence, of impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and the resulting suffering that comes from the interplay of the misunderstanding of those two. Once these qualities are developed, there are four more to develop. Contemplation of what is unattractive so as to abandon craving. Goodwill should be developed so as to abandon ill will. Mindfulness of the breath in the body should be developed so as to develop non-distraction. This is such an interesting line to me. There's been so many additional practices of mindfulness of the breath, or using mindfulness of the breath to develop very distracting and analytical practices, when the Buddha taught to simply be mindful of the breath, how the breath occurs, and use that unembellished mindfulness of the breath as the foundation for deepening concentration. That's the point of the four foundations of mindfulness. Again, I'm not putting down all the other applications of mindfulness, but in this context, the Buddha's teaching to just use the mindfulness of the breath as he taught it, and not get into a long analytical and distracting practice of breath meditation. Mindfulness of the breath and the body should be developed so as to develop non-distraction. That's the sole reason why we use mindfulness of the breath. In other words, not to get into examination of how the breath might be tied to pain or emotions, or past lives, or all kinds of other things, just to develop non-distraction. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to root out conceit and further eye-making. For when one understands impermanence, clinging to not-self is abandoned. Understanding not-self uproots conceit. Unbinding arises in this moment. So in this sutta, the Buddha is teaching those assembled the importance of choosing associations wisely, and just how those associations can support developing the Eightfold Path. As he was addressing those staying in their monastery, the Buddha was reaffirming their commitment to their Sangha. This lesson is also appropriate for all of us. Choosing associations wisely helps maintain a supportive environment for developing those qualities that are requirements to achieve awakening. One of the rules of the Potimokkha, the rules for the monastic life, is that when gathered as a Sangha to keep discussions on the Dhamma and avoid distractions of other teachings and activities. I know that at Cross River Meditation Center, my center in Frenchtown, for the first few years, it was always a bit of a challenge to not get into other practices, even Buddhist practices or other New Age practices that people had become enamored with. Back then, nearly every class, someone had a talk by someone that they wanted to introduce, or to use the class itself to listen to tapes and talks by other teachers who really weren't teaching what the Buddha taught, but were had gained quite a lot of favor in modern Buddhism. And I always insisted that in our Sangha that we only teach what we know and only talk about what we know came directly from the Buddha. And it was because of this, because of understanding this, the Buddha was saying that when we're gathered as a Sangha, we discuss the Dhamma and we don't discuss other teachings, and we don't discuss other things that may prove to be a distraction. And so even in the Buddha's day, he's referring to talk about politics or maybe even what's going on in the economy, etc. When we're together as a Dhamma, we talk about the Dhamma. And that's how we support each other. To some, that may sound even exclusive or protectionist. Remember that the Buddha left his life as his father's, as a prince in his father's kingdom. He left that life of luxury, not so much that he was rejecting the trappings of luxury, but what he was rejecting was the simple trappings of a secular life with what follows from that, and that he wanted to be in a spot that where the Dhamma was focused on and discussed. Most of us cannot do that. We can't just leave our lives and join a monastery or even develop some kind of isolated individual practice. Excuse me. But as far as our Dhamma practice is concerned, we can seek out and find a well-focused Sangha, a Sangha that is well-focused on the Four Noble Truths, or to start our own, which is how Buddhism, how the Buddha's teachings grew from his time to being to be a factor all over the world, even today, 2,600 years later. Let me just read one little bit more from this. In a monastery setting, observing this simple rule, hearing easily sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding, in our modern life, it is not so simple. Many times we have no choice who we are with, but being in physical proximity does not necessarily bring association. Association can be an aspect of clinging. In other words, if we are creating a self-identity by the so-called Buddhist practitioners that we are associating with, that's an aspect of clinging, and we cannot help but be influenced by that. It's better to be a light in the storm and carry the Buddha's true teachings into other associations that might not be as well focused if we're really going to practice the Buddha's Dhamma. Creating an identity based on associations can be very subtle, but it's also very common. This is why the qualities brought to mind in this sutta are so effective in developing and maintaining a true Dhamma practice and remaining free of distracting entanglements. Another thing that's interesting to me over time is how nearly every individual school of Buddhism, from even worldwide organizations down to local, maybe local sanghas, has to it's almost a compulsive way of creating more eye making through your associations in your local sangha or in a worldwide sangha. So I'm not going to put down a lot of different organizations by mentioning by name, but almost invariably they create a special name that they are now members of this special thing, this special sangha, that sets them apart, and they're trying to create this specialness within this common compulsive need to create an all-inclusive, one-size-fits-all Dhamma. And all that that's doing is creating a specialness within that particular sangha. The Buddha never called his sangha anything else except the sangha. He never set himself up, used the word Buddha as an appellation to set him above other people or the people that joined him. They were simply bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. For 45 years, he never found the need to create a special name. And that was carried on even after the Buddha's death. The labels that started to be applied to Buddhist practitioners didn't even come into force until there was a sect within the Buddhist teaching that wanted to separate themselves from those that were carrying on the traditional Buddhist teachings, meaning traditions related to what the Buddha taught, and create their own visionary type of Buddhism. This is a sect called the Mahasanghikas, which would prove to be the foundation for the later developed Mahayana schools, which have led to the kind of modern thicket of views that we have today. They wanted a type of Buddhism that was more mystical, that they could establish the Buddha as a god and one of many Buddhas stretching back infinitely to the past and infinitely to the future, something quite different than the Buddha taught. And they were, at least as far as we can tell, they were the first group that gave themselves a name. And now it seems like everyone, whether you're a little local sangha or you're part of a worldwide organization, they all have developed their own special names and their own special orders and almost invariably their own special practices that are usually contradicting to the Buddhist teachings. And again, I'm not putting down what other people are doing, but to point out the importance of maintaining our associations with the Buddha's Dhamma in a wise way and our associations within our Dhamma practice in a wise way. The way that we can be certain of doing that, of course, is to use the Buddha's path that he taught to overcome that need, that conditioned response, to form associations by what we would like things to be rather than the reality of it. And of course, that is the Eightfold Path. If we practice the Eightfold Path as our Dhamma practice, we cannot help but remain well-focused in the Buddha's Dhamma. There's no need to create any kind of specialness over the Buddhist teachings. It is simply the most important and most effective teaching of all time. But it needs no special label. In fact, when we start creating specialness, we're getting ourselves into some difficulties. So that's the talk for today. For the last couple of weeks, I've been emphasizing online and also in my classes the importance to remain well focused on the Buddhist teachings and avoid the modern thicket of views that's out there. Again, I don't mean to disparage any teaching, but it is important to recognize the differences between what the Buddha taught and what has arisen. This was a common problem even during the Buddha's time, and it seems to have only spread and become more confusing for all of us. I know for so many years, probably the first 15 or 20 years of my so-called Buddhist practice, I was following different lineages to the letter. I was doing everything I was told to do and learning everything I was told to learn and practicing everything I was practicing. I was told to practice, engaging in all types of different rituals and chanting. And I was always confused as to where this was taking me. And I was taking a lot of that on faith because an organization that I wanted to associate with was laying something out in a certain way and saying this is Buddhist practice. I simply followed that. And I ignored my own misgivings about that. And it wasn't until I developed a true understanding of what the Buddha awakened to, meaning dependent origination. Dependent origination, which states from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises, that it was my insistence on ignoring what I intuitively felt was an ineffective practice, but because I was so strongly associated with that practice, I didn't recognize my own ignorance. And it wasn't until I started looking at what the Buddha actually taught and understanding dependent origination in a very profound way that I recognized that it really was my associations with different schools that were creating my confusion. And it wasn't until I let go of those associations and stopped identifying myself as this type of Buddhist or that type of Buddhist and simply developed what the Buddha actually taught in the manner that he taught, that it made all the difference in the world, and it changed everything about me in relation to the world. It made all the difference, which is exactly what the Buddha found too, and why he taught what he taught. So I see that there's two people that have viewed me today. I'm sorry, I still haven't figured out this chat, but I thank you for joining me, and I hope to see you next Wednesday. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.